At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hello, how are you doing? Welcome to another episode of Textory. We are diving into a really strange topic today that I feel like is maybe a little misrepresented by the media that are dealing with the Victorian era. But at the same time, they were onto something. Like, I don't think it's just our modern conception of it. Anyway, before we get into it, just a reminder that I have a Patreon. So if you enjoy the podcast, if you want the podcast to keep running, please head to patreon.com/textory, where you'll discover a variety of wonderful perks. Now, let's get back to the episode. So our today's heroine, is that how you pronounce it? I never know. Like, what's the difference between the woman and the drug? That sounded very poetic. Anyway, I wanted to say guest, but no, she actually has passed away over 100 years ago, probably. But Lola Montez was basically a dancer, but she used a stage name. Her actual name was Eliza Rosanna Gilbert, Countess of Lansfeld. So in 1843, she had her London debut as Lola Montez, the Spanish dancer. So despite the fact that she was actually Irish, had nothing to do with Spain. Those were the days where you could just take a whole new identity, become very mysterious about your past life, and just become a Spanish dancer. But she was not only a dancer, she also became a courtesan and a mistress of King Ludwig I of Bavaria. There was even a rumor that when they first met, Ludwig asked her in public if her breasts were real. I don't know if that actually happened. But if it did, it's 100% something that a king could say without any consequences. So I kind of believe it. And the cool thing about royal mistresses is that they weren't just this decoration on the king's arm. They actually had power and they had a lot of influence. Like, Lola was so powerful that her views affected what the king was doing. And also, he ended up abdicating, and historians speculate that this was sort of because of her. Not directly, but one of the reasons why he was unpopular within his people was that he wanted to give her a title. He wanted to naturalize her, even though she was just his mistress. So let's just say she was not without consequence. Anyway, after that relationship was over, she tried reviving her dancing career. So she toured Australia in 1855. In 1857, she came to the US. She also started acting and giving lectures on gallantry. And I'm assuming that the text that we're reading today must be based on those lectures because it came out a year after. It's called The Arts of Beauty. It was published in London. In general, it's like a beauty guide. It has a lot of recipes for how to keep beautiful, for how to create cosmetics that will help you keep beautiful. But what I find most interesting is the chapter on ankles, because there is a whole chapter on how to keep your ankles beautiful. And then apart from that chapter, because it's a little bit too short for a whole episode, we'll also read some more beauty tips by her. I assume she knew what she was talking about, judging by the paintings and the photographs that we have of her. She was indeed a baddie. So I am going to listen to her advice. I'm going to at least listen to what she has to say. It will be difficult to overestimate the importance of a well-proportioned foot and ankle as a part of female beauty. There is delightful promise in a fine foot and ankle. Virgil tells us that by her gentle walk, the Queen of Love is known, and that gentle walk will rarely, if ever, be found connected with a heavy and an ill-shaped foot and ankle. We know it is natural for the mind to associate every other charm with that of a graceful step. Thus Milton sung, "Grace was in all her steps, heaven in her eyes, in every gesture, dignity and love." So she starts off with a bunch of food-related quotes. Not only food, but like the whole apparatus of walking, steps, all that. And she says that a well-proportioned foot and ankle is the basis of female beauty. What I find interesting is the sentence, "There is a delightful promise in a fine foot and ankle," because it sounds very saucy for a Victorian woman to be saying that. Because, like, what is it a promise of? The higher up part of the leg? Why are you thinking about what a woman has under her skirts? It's quite risky to start off a book like that. But then again, she was a courtesan, so she probably didn't really care. "The pains which some nations take to ensure a small foot amounts to a torture, which ought to be called by no other name than that of the art of deforming. In China especially, this thing is carried to such an extent that the women's feet are entirely spoiled. In Spain, however, the art is practiced with astonishing success in causing beautifully small feet. I have known ladies there who were past 20 years of age to sleep every night with bandages on their feet and ankles drawn as tight as they could be and not stop the circulation. There is nothing that a Spanish beauty is more proud of than a small and beautiful foot and ankle, and nowhere do you find more of those charms than in Spain." I am dying to know what the actual Spanish ladies thought of that, because either she was smart enough to ask them or travel to Spain and observe, or she just made the whole thing up because she obviously wasn't Spanish. So I'm just imagining Spanish ladies buying the book by Lola Montez and going like, "Oh my God, that's so interesting." And then, "What? That's not at all what goes down here." "A great cause of thick ankles among women of the cities who are fashionably and genteelly brought up is a want of exercise and sitting indolently in overheated rooms. Such habits are quite sure to produce slight swelling of the ankles and cause a chronic flabbiness of the muscles. You might as well expect to see a rosebush spring, bud, and bloom in a closely pent oven as to anticipate fine and healthy proportions from a long continuance of such habits. Let every lady be assured that there is no part of her body which will suffer more from want of proper exercise than her feet and ankles." I mean, fair, lack of exercise is probably not the best thing for your legs' health in general, but also, if it was only about lack of exercise, I would probably not be walking at this point, because we are nowadays leading very sitting lifestyles. So we would all be walking around with swollen ankles and chronic flabbiness of the muscles, as she puts it, due to it, if that was the case. "But woman's chief art in making the most out of this portion of her charms must consist in properly and tastefully dressing them. Let her start with the maxim that she had better wear a bad bonnet than a bad shoe. Let her believe that an ill-fitting dress will not do so much towards breaking the charm of her beauty in the mind of a man as a loose and soiled stocking." So she's saying that it all comes down to the way we dress the ankle. It comes down to what sort of stockings we use. It comes down to the fit of the shoe. I kind of assumed she's going to talk about unhealthy footwear, but no, she focuses mostly on the aesthetics of the dress. "The celebrated Madame Vestry used to have her white satin boots sewed on her feet every morning, in order that they should perfectly fit the exquisite shape of her foot. Of course, they had to be ripped off at night, and the same pair could never be worn but once. This famous beauty rejoiced in the reputation of having the handsomest foot of any woman in the world, and it was said that she made more conquests with her feet than with her face, beautiful as it was." Okay, I'm not sure what she means by the boots being sewed onto her feet, because if she meant closing the boots, like instead of the front lacing, it would be sewed onto it. I don't think it really matters if you do it, because that doesn't affect the shape of the foot. If she, however, meant sewing the upper part of the shoe to the sole, then yes, that would probably affect the fit of the shoe on the foot. But then that's actually insane. And it's probably made up, as most of the information in this book. Because let's face it, the lady was basically an imposter. That was her job. That's what she was good at. So why would we trust anything that she says? If a lady has not a naturally beautiful foot, her care is directed to the means of preventing attention from being called to it. For this reason, she dresses it as neatly but as soberly as possible. Her hope is in a plain black shoe, and she especially eschews all gay colors and all ornaments, which would be sure to attract the eye to a spot of which she cannot be proud. Indeed, bright-colored shoes are in bad taste for anybody, except on certain brilliant occasions where fancy dresses are worn. So what she's saying is, if your feet are ugly, just don't show them. Hide them. Interesting point about bright-colored shoes only belonging to fancy dress costumes, because judging by excellent examples, that's not at all what they did. But because it's 1858... which is an age where the variety of the shoes was maybe not that wide, I kind of understand where she's coming from. Above all things, every lady of taste avoids an ornamented stocking. Stockings with open-wove ornamented insteps denote a vulgar taste, and instead of displaying a fine proportion, confuse the contour of a pretty foot. But where the ankle is rather large or square, a pretty unobtrusive net cloak of the same color as the stocking will be a useful device and induce the beholder to believe in the perfect symmetry of the parts. Okay, so I'm not sure what she's saying here. First, she says that you shouldn't draw attention to your feet if they're not pretty. Then she says if your ankles are ugly, you should conceal them with ornamented stockings. So she's kind of contradicting herself here. Though a woman is to be fully conscious of the charm of a pretty foot and ankle, yet she must not seem to be so. Nothing will draw the laugh on her so quick as a manifestly designed exhibition of these parts. It is no doubt a very difficult thing for a lady who has a fine foot to keep it from creeping forth into sight beneath the dress. But let her be sure that the charm is gone the moment the beholder detects it is done designedly. If men are not modest themselves, they will never forgive a woman if she is not. This sounds like she's speaking from experience. Because obviously, being a courtesan, she probably was not considered a very modest woman. And this is something that actually astonishes me a little bit in this text, is how careful she is with not being vulgar and with being modest. And I'm just thinking, I wonder if women reading this book thought that she is a reliable person to be saying that, because obviously her being an actress, a dancer, and a mistress to the king was not the ideal modest Victorian woman. Before leaving this subject, I must not forget to speak of the importance to a lady of a genteel and sprightly walk. The practiced eye detects the quality of a woman's mind and heart in her step. Nor is this an idle fancy, for the reason that every situation of the soul, every internal movement, has its regular progression in the external action of the body. We may say, as Seneca makes the wife of Hercules say of Lycus, his mind is like his walk. An indistinct, shuffling, irregular, sluggish, and slovenly walk is a tolerably sure sign of corresponding attributes of the soul. And on the other hand, an affected, pert, vain, and pedantic step draws upon a woman the worst impressions from the opposite gender. But there is a remarkable charm in a walk characterized by blended dignity and vivacity. It leaves upon the beholder a lasting impression of those attributes of mind which most surely awaken esteem and admiration. What I find really interesting is that this is not the first Victorian era text that judges people by their appearance. I've read a lot of texts where people are like, if a person's forehead is shaped this and this way, that means they're stubborn. If a person's hands look like this, that means they're selfish, la la la. Speaking of hands, we have finished the ankle chapter, so let's move on to hands. A beautiful hand performs a great mission in the life of a bell. Indeed, the hand has a language of its own, which is often most intelligible when the tongue and every other part of the human body is compelled to be mute. When timid lovers have never dared to open their mouths to each other, their hands will get together and express all the passion that glows within. Or, often when two lovers are annoyed by the presence of a rigid mother or guardian, they secretly squeeze each other's hands, which says loud enough for their hearts to hear, "What a pity we are not alone." And when parting in the presence of the crowd, how much is said, how much promised in that gentle pressure of the hands. 100% agree, let's bring back hand touch. Basically, what I think should be way more prevalent in modern society, especially in dating and especially in like courting and early phases of the relationship. Let's bring back hand touch. Why is no one touching each other's hands in a romantic way? And obviously back then it was way more meaningful because people did not get to touch each other that much. So a simple handshake or a caress of the hand was obviously very exciting back then. But I think there is something really charming about hand touch. I think it's very romantic and I think it's so delicate. And as she says, it can convey so much emotions when you can't talk. But besides the secret and potent language of the hand, it is a great ornament as a thing of beauty. The great Petrarch confesses that Laura's beautiful hand made captive his heart. And there is no woman who is not conscious of the power she has in the possession of a charming hand. The Spanish ladies take, if possible, more pains with their hands than with their faces. There is no end of the tricks to which they resort to render this organ delicate and beautiful. Some of these devices are not only painful, but exceedingly ridiculous. For instance, I have known some of them to sleep every night with their hands held up to the bedpost by pulleys, hoping by that means to render them pale and delicate. I'm calling cap on this because, girl, you haven't even lived in Spain. But it's interesting how back then you could basically make up anything and no one could tell you anything because they had no sources. Both Spanish and French women, those at least who are very particular to make the most of these charms, are in the habit of sleeping in gloves, which are lined or plastered over with a kind of pomade to improve the delicacy and complexion of their hands. This paste is generally made of the following ingredients. Take 1/2 pound of soft soap, a gill of salad oil, an ounce of mutton tallow, and boil them till they are thoroughly mixed. After the boiling has ceased, but before it is cold, add 1 gill of spirits of wine and a grain of musk. What I find quite interesting is that it's not necessarily unheard of to be wearing gloves filled with some sort of cream and be wearing them overnight. Like, this is a genuine cosmetic treatment that is still available nowadays. I think I must have used gloves like this once or twice when my hands were particularly dry. So there is some merit in this. And also the pomade that she is using, maybe the ingredients sound a bit off, but to be fair, when we think about them, it's basically just oils and fats and it doesn't sound that bad, I have to say that. If any lady wishes to try this, she can buy a pair of gloves 3 or 4 sizes larger than the hand, rip them open and spread on a thin layer of the paste and then sew the gloves up again. This is basically what we're doing. The gloves I was using as sort of like a hand mask were basically those massive plastic gloves that were filled with some sort of cream or mask. And they have just done it for me. They've soaked them with the cream before I had to do it. So back then it was much more DIY, but the general idea remains the same. There is no doubt that by wearing them every night, they will give smoothness and a fine complexion to the hands. Those who have the means can send to Paris and purchase them ready-made. Okay, so pretty much what we're doing nowadays. But I am not aware that they have been imported to this country. It will not surprise me, however, to learn that they have been, for fashionable ladies are remarkably quick at finding out the tricks which the belles elsewhere resort to for the purpose of beautifying themselves. Sleeping in simple white kid gloves will make the skin of the hand white and soft. Of course, no lady who wishes to be particular about her hands will ever go out into the air without her gloves. I have to say, when I was younger, I didn't really understand the Victorian obsession with gloves. But then I realized it's mostly about blocking out the UV rays, because we all know stories of someone's grandma who always wore gloves, and when she was really old, her hands kept looking like she's in her 20s. Yeah, because they were never exposed to the sun. And it is true that people that wear gloves a lot will have skin that is probably more smooth and paler than most people. Nowadays, luckily, we also have creams with a UV filter, sunscreens and all that stuff, so we can protect our hands better. But back then, it was a genuine social status thing to be able to be wearing gloves all the time and to keep your hands wrinkle-free and pale. And this is something that lasted well into the 50s. It requires almost as much labor and attention to keep the hands in order as it does to preserve the beauty of the face. Taking care of the nails alone is an art which few women understand, for 8 out of 10 of even fashionable ladies always appear with their nails neither tastefully trimmed nor otherwise in good condition. The nail, properly managed, should be smooth, transparent, and nearly rose-colored. Okay, whatever you say, Lola, I mean, I believe you. Honestly, check out her portraits. She was a gorgeous woman. She did kind of look Spanish, so I definitely can see where that came from and why people believed her. What I want to know is how deep she went in pretending that she's Spanish, because as we can see in this book, she definitely kept up her persona even after she left Bavaria and after she was no longer the king's mistress. But then again, I'm just wondering, what was the Spanish ladies at the time reaction to her as a person? Like, did they see through it? Did they just not say anything? Or was it a matter of maybe just a language barrier? Maybe she just did not really go to Spain, perform in Spain, or publish her works in Spain. I'm actually not sure. This is really interesting. But what I also find interesting is what I've already said about her being this sort of like moral compass in this text, or showing herself as a person that knows what is and what isn't modest and proper. Whereas, obviously, by the women of the time, she may have been considered a beauty and she may have been considered in some ways to be inspiring, but definitely not in the ways of being modest and proper. So I'm assuming she popped those in just so the ladies that bought this little book did not feel bad about themselves or did not have to explain to their husbands and people around them that they're reading a courtesan's book on beauty. But they could be like, no, she's talking that you need to keep modest and you can't wear ornamented stockings because that's in bad taste. So that's my theory. Let me know what you think about it. I think that's it. I hope you keep your ankles and hands happy and healthy, and you're not affected by what she said about the things that she did not consider a beauty standard, because that's one ruthless thing about Victorian texts, is that they truly don't care. Because every time I'm reading a text like this, I'm like, what if someone that actually had those kind of ankles read the text and then felt really bad? And I wonder if people were just so self-aware that they were not affected, or if they were just reading this like, okay, I guess I'm ugly then. Because it's really, I just wonder. I just find it really interesting. And I usually say that, but it really is very interesting. And I wish I could see or hear people's reaction to books like this, because it's one thing to read it as a modern person, but it's another to read it as a Victorian. And I know I'm never going to get that. My time machine is old and rusty and is not really running anymore, so I can't travel back in time and ask them that. I think it's really fun to speculate what people's reactions were at the time. Anyway, I think that's it. Thank you guys for listening, and I'll hear you in another episode. Bye!